evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 27, 2019. South Sudanese Canadians are mourning one of their members killed by the police.
Because there is a lot of options that they can de-escalate. They have to call me, they have to call other people. You don't need to rush it to conclusion to finish up the case, whatever reason. So I don't know how, but I don't have the police to tell him what.
And the UN Agency for Refugees say about 140,000 refugees have returned home.
Over 142,000 South Sudanese refugees who reside in neighboring country return spontaneously to South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 140,000 South Sudanese refugees have voluntarily returned from Sudan, Congo, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda since the signing of the revitalized peace deal. But the UN agency says, the UN spokesman in South Sudan says most of the returnees are unable to return to their villages due in large to continued insecurity. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
UNHCR says some 400,000 South Sudanese have been displaced internally, while more than 2.2 million people fled to neighboring countries since the conflict began in December 2013. UNHCR says despite its non-return advisory for refugees, they are voluntarily returning because they are hoping the peace deal last year will hold. Eugene Byun is the UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan.
As of the 31st of January 2019, we have information that this is triangulated information saying that over 142,000 South Sudanese refugees who reside in neighboring country return spontaneously to South Sudan.
Byun says the refugee agency was only able to contact about 20,000 of the 142,000 returnees. But Byun points out that most returnees find it difficult to return to their villages and start over again.
85% of 142,000, they are not able to go back to their place of origin. So meaning that they fall into the IDP-likely situation when they come back to their home country. There's various reasons for that. The first, insecurity, of course. They cannot go back to their hometown because there is a conflict ongoing and then there is insecurity. Second, because their land and house was destroyed or occupied by others.
Recent fighting in Yei River State has forced more than 5,000 people to seek refuge in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. Byun says even though a peace agreement was signed and the violence in most parts of the country has fallen, it is still not encouraging refugees to return to the country. She says for now, UNHCR is keeping its non-return policy in place, which means it is advising refugees not to return to South Sudan because conditions there are not safe.
Even though UNHCR's non-return the advisory is remain valid, if South Sudanese want to go back to their country, it's their right to return.
Three UN agencies warned last week that two-thirds of the population, or 7 million South Sudanese, could face starvation this year. Byun says UNHCR and other agencies have deployed teams at the border crossing areas between South Sudan and its neighborings to be able to identify the needs of returning refugees. But she stresses UNHCR will not provide any additional assistance. John Dabi is the South Sudan Deputy Commissioner for Refugee Affairs.
Those who return on their own, they're profiling them so that you document who has come, where did they come from. All this kind of information is needed so that when UNHCR is on board, they can be able to fund and support the areas where there's no water, they put the water. Where there's no school, we ask them to put a school. Where there's no health facility, we ask them to put facility.
Dabi says the government has no resources to provide assistance to IDPs or returnees. He says many returnees want to see how the peace deal is implemented.
Some of the people, they are coming to see whether the peace will really exist. And then they might go back, but they might stay, so they are weighing. Secondly, there's also economical challenge in the camps. The situation in the camps where they are living in Uganda is not really conducive for people.
Yesterday, members of the East African Community Secretariat met in Juba to develop a unified refugee management policy for the region, which will guide assistance and refugees management. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The South Sudanese community in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Canada, are demanding answers from police after officers opened fire on a South Sudanese man, killing him in his apartment complex. Ayen Deng Bior reports for VOA from Washington.
Machuar Mawen Madut was shot 3 times at close range in his apartment complex on Saturday morning around 9:30. He is remembered by his cousin Aye Madut as a father of 3 teenagers who cared about his children and was a kind and simple man.
The man is really a humble man. He doesn't really associate himself with where there is a conflict, or he doesn't have any political view that's going to involve him to disagree with the people or everything. He just, a person that have open heart, want to have a peaceful minded, like everybody, just stay quiet in the middle of the communities or in a public place. You find him, Mashar is sitting down, having a coffee, or he's just sitting down, listening to what the people say.
The last time Madut saw Mawen was Friday night. Madut, who lives above the apartment that Mawen lived in, says Mawen had mental illness that would sometimes cause him to stay up all night. He says the morning of the incident, Mawen had an episode that caused him to walk around the apartment and move objects around. Madut went to work Saturday morning around 8:30, and less than 2 hours later, he received a call that there was heavy police presence at Mawin's house.
They're supposed to read the body language. They're supposed to understand what kind of engagement they are going. But unfortunately, that is not the case. Because if you don't need to be a doctor to read somebody with a problem, but there is a lot of information around this. So, to use the lethal force, I don't see it, especially in this individual. You cannot use, because there is a lot of options that they can de-escalate. They have to call me, they have to call other people. You don't need to rush into a conclusion to finish up the case, whatever reason.
It's unclear if anyone was in the apartment at the time of the shooting. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reports the South Sudanese community in Winnipeg, the capital city of the Canadian province of Manitoba, are planning a rally at the city's police station on Friday to protest Mawen's death. The shooting has sent shockwaves across the South Sudanese community, according to Madut, who is still trying to get answers from police.
And we're just trying to figure out why they don't reach out, because the incident doesn't, when you put all the picture, doesn't match, because the guy, the company that he was renting, I informed them the guy has mental issues, and I'm working with the health care to take him to where he's supposed to be. So everybody know what is going on. How the police call, what the reaction with the individuals, that question nobody now has to answer. So they're just saying we are investigating this.
Winnipeg police could not be immediately reached for comment. Ayen Deng Bior, VOA News, Washington.
The South Sudan government has been sued by the Terrain Hotel for failing to pay damages incurred when government soldiers ransacked the hotel, raped international aid workers, and killed a local journalist in July 2016. A lawyer representing the Terrain Hotel says he has petitioned the court to ensure that the Defense Ministry complies with the military court order. Wake Simon Wudu has the details for VOA from Juba.
The court ruled in September last year the government's defense ministry must pay $2.3 million to the Terrain in damages. Terrain lawyer Philip Anyang says it's been 6 months since the court ruling and the government has yet to pay the hotel a single dollar.
Despite giving them enough time, they didn't do what is expected of them. They didn't comply with the court's orders. And now we want the court to get back again, because a defeated party goes back to court. So we went back to court to ensure that our awards are granted as ordered by court.
Following the court's ruling in September, Anyang says the government was supposed to respond to the court within 15 days, which it failed to do or make any attempt to contact the hotel management to set a payment system to pay the $2.3 million in installments. Now, Anyang's team is petitioning the military court, which had the case, to force the defense ministry to comply with its ruling, and if the government says it has no money, then the court should seize government assets.
The ministry has been advised by court to file a response, or we move to the next stage. If they don't comply with it, of course we move for attachment. They have properties, they have cars, we know they have a lot of properties. We'll just ask God that attach these properties and sell them.
Brigadier General Santo Domeche, the military deputy spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, or SSPDF, confirms the Ministry of Defense on behalf of the government has not paid the $2.3 million in compensation to Terrain Hotel.
What I know as far as the whole thing is concerned, that should the payment delay, it did not delay because of anything else. It is because of maybe lack of liquidity. But the Minister of Defense is committed to meet the payment for Terrain Hotel.
Aside from ordering the $2.3 million compensation, the military court also sentenced 10 soldiers to several years in prison for raping international aid workers. Two other soldiers were sentenced to life in prison for killing a local journalist. The government was also ordered to pay $20,000 to 5 rape victims and 51 head of cattle to the family of the murdered journalist. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more than 100 bank employees in South Sudan go on strike. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what traditional medicines do you take, if any?
I don't take any traditional medicine as a young, active African. I think I'm strong enough. I use water and more of the fruits. I think my parents do a lot of traditional medicine.
I haven't taken traditional medicine yet. I hope I never do, because I'm biased about traditional medicine. I think people put in so much spiritual things to make sure that their medicine works, so I've not given it a try.
Yeah, I take, but I don't know the biological names in English. Yeah, but I take there is this Mururuza. I don't know how they call it in English. And the aloe vera chigaji. Yeah, I take Mururuza and the aloe vera for treatment of malaria. Very good. Most of myself, I use it for much, too much.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. More than 100 employees of the Kenyan-owned cooperative bank staged a peaceful strike today in Juba for pay rise and better working conditions. One employee says the staff repeatedly complained about low salaries, but bank management never responded. The bank's managing director in South Sudan says his team is negotiating with the employees to resolve the matter. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
About 80 employees of the Cooperative Bank of South Sudan gathered at Nyakron Cultural Center to stage the protest. 40 other South Sudanese staff employed at the bank's Nimule branch also went on strike. A staff representative who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisals from the management says bank employees started raising concerns in 2016, but aside from being told their concerns were conveyed to management in Nairobi, the complaints fell on deaf ears.
They are mainly welfare issues of staff welfare, majorly the salary increment, medical, and general working conditions of the national staff. We appreciate that at every level, there are negotiations and the engagements, which the national staffs were very committed and tried to engage with management of the bank to ensure that some of these issues generally are sorted in the bank. It is unfortunate that whereas the struggle started way back in 2017 or even 2016, no any clear communication came out.
Another employee who declined to be identified by name for fear of reprisals from bank management says the salary is too little to put food on the table due to the weakening value of the local currency and skyrocketing prices of goods in the market.
There were several requests that we forwarded to the management, and basically for the salary, the solution that we came up with was an increment of salary to 150%, of which when we tabled to them, there was not any positive response.
A third employee, who also preferred to speak on condition of anonymity for the same reason as others, says the South Sudanese staff will remain on strike until the demands are met.
We are ready for anybody who is coming for negotiation. If the management comes and we get to the point we think it can be good to both of us, for the bank and for the national staffs, well, we'll just go back for work. But if there is nothing like that, actually we can continue with this kind of strike.
Elijah Mawalua, Cooperative Bank's managing director, acknowledges that the employees complained about their salaries, medical insurance, and early pension payment after the South Sudanese pound fell against the U.S. dollar. But Mawalua says the management is negotiating with the employees to resolve the issue amicably.
We're already in discussion with our staff. Even as we speak, we already have some timelines within which we'll meet and discuss a few other issues. We were in discussion yesterday as well for 3 good hours.
Juma Yohan Kebi, acting undersecretary for the Labour Ministry, says he received a letter yesterday from the bank's South Sudanese employees, but expected them to discuss their concerns with bank management and then report to the ministry if they failed to reach an agreement rather than walk off the job. Kebi says he is not aware of the exact concerns of the employees because they did not invite a representative from the ministry during their previous meetings.
If it's the issues of salaries, increment and so on, to the best of my knowledge, a representative from the management came to the ministry and met the minister and raised these points to the minister that they have done so and so and so. But it still is a one side. You cannot judge from hearing from one side.
In January last year, more than 160 employees of Kenya Commercial Bank went on strike demanding a pay increase to meet the higher commodity prices. And in January 2016, more than 200 employees of Equity Bank went on strike demanding better pay, medical coverage, and flexible working hours. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The United States, Britain, Norway and Canada has expressed concern over Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir's return to military rule, which was announced on Friday after he appointed 16 army officers and 2 officers from the National Intelligence and Security Services as governors of the country's 18 states. Joseph Sigley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke to VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi about Bashir's actions and the possible scenarios in Sudan.
It seems like President Bashir is trying to ramp up his repression of the protests. The previous efforts have failed to quell the dissatisfaction. And so the state of emergency is an opportunity that he's tried to use more repressive tactics to try to bring these protests to heel.
The United States, Britain, Norway, and Canada expressed concern on Tuesday over Sudanese president's return to military rule after he appointed 16 army officers and 2 officers from the powerful National Intelligence and Security Services as governors for the country's 18 provinces. Would that pressure change the Sudanese president's approach?
Yes and no. I think President Bashir has taken these steps because he feels he needs to do so. You know, he effectively is saying that he's going to double down on repression as a way of stopping the protest and staying in power. And to do that, he needed to try to consolidate support of security services. So his appointment is partly political, but partly as a way of ensuring that he can mobilize, you know, the course of structures of the government to try and effectively solve the protest. Now, he very much is mindful of international pressure. Sudan is suffering with, you know, 73% inflation. It has about a $55 billion foreign debt. And so it will need support from the international community to stabilize the economy once they resolve the political crisis. And so by taking this action, he is really closing off opportunities to secure that international support. And so it will lead to a longer term crisis, and the underlying economic issues that have led to the crisis are going to get worse.
So what are the possible scenarios in Sudan with relentless protests and a stubborn ruler?
I think this could go in several ways. One, he may, in the process of ramping up the repression, we will see more violence. And he will try to crush the protest by arresting the leaders and really sending a signal to protesters that their views aren't going to be tolerated. However, because of the underlying economic crisis that the country is facing, it's unclear how successful that's going to be, because the pressures that have led to the dissatisfaction are going to be there. And so it's possible, another scenario, that we will see some sort of split within the security services, maybe intelligence services, pushing Bashir out. And in that way, since he is sort of the fulcrum of the protest, I think there may be a calculation among some in the security services to say, well, if he leaves, that will reduce the pressure, and then we can carry on. So it would be, you know, maintaining of the regime, more or less, without Bashir, but with other security actors in play. And I think, a third scenario would be that the protesters remain resilient and say, listen, conditions are already bad, and this repression isn't going to change anything. You know, our lives are still very difficult. Bread, fuel prices are rising. Inflation is stripping away whatever savings we have. We don't have anything to lose. And if they push back against the repression, you know, there is still the scenario that the regime will fall and there will be some sort of transition government installed, maybe in coordination with some in the security services that realize that, you know, they need some sort of legitimacy if they're going to navigate the economic crisis, and then it would reduce social pressures. And so you would see some sort of power-sharing arrangement for the next year or 18 months until elections can be held in 2020.
That's Joseph Stigley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. The World Food Program is airlifting 36 metric tons of life-saving food to 18,000 people in Zomio, Central Africa Republic. The WFP reports Zomio, a region 1,000 kilometers east of the capital Bangui, is unreachable by road because of insecurity and transport difficulties. Lisha Slein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This is the first time since a year that the UN World Food Program has launched an airlift of this scale in the Central African Republic. The WFP says the worsening security situation and impossibility of bringing food supplies into Zomio by road has created a food and nutritional crisis in the region. The operation involves 8 airlift rotations. WFP has completed 6 of them. The remaining food supplies are being airlifted to families in Zomio on Wednesday. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoesel says the arrival of food by air is coming at a crucial time for thousands of displaced people who are unable to move around freely because of increased violence. He tells VOA that WFP will reevaluate the situation in Zomio in the coming weeks to see whether airlifts should resume.
Because of the military and the security situation, most of the people are IDPs, are displaced in IDPs camp. They have no access to the market. They have no access either to the field to cultivate. As a result of that, the malnutrition, including for children, is important there, but also in the country.
The United Nations reports nearly half of CAR's population of 4.7 million is short of food. A recent national nutritional survey shows more than 7% of children aged 6 to 59 months are suffering from acute malnutrition. Verhusel says the WFP will continue to scale up emergency aid for vulnerable people in the country. But he says the agency's operation is costly, especially when airlifts are factored in. He says far less than half of the agency's $145 million appeal for this year has been met, and that it is critical for this funding gap to be closed. The CAR has been in conflict since a coup in 2013. The current government in Bangui signed a peace agreement in 2017 with several of the warring militias in the country, but it has proved ineffective, and in recent months, violence has flared up again. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Cairo, where a passenger train crashed today in the Egyptian capital, killing many passengers. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The accident at the Ramses railway station set off a massive fireball, incinerating the front cars of the train and causing horrific burns to passengers and bystanders on the platform adjacent to the crash. Surveillance cameras capture the incident, showing bystanders on fire and running to escape the inferno. One security camera showed a man, his body on fire, running down a set of stairs before collapsing. Rescue workers reported that many of the casualties were in critical condition, suffering severe burns. Fire and rescue vehicles rushed to the scene during the morning rush hour. Fire crews doused the burning passenger cars, and many people inside the front cars were thought to have been incinerated by the fire and extreme heat of the blaze. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly told reporters on the platform after visiting the crash site that every effort was being made to determine what happened. He says the era of keeping silent and sweeping things under the rug has come to an end, and the government will do its utmost to determine what happened and who was responsible, with a committee investigating the crash. Witnesses say the train did not slow down as it approached the station. Egyptian railways are beset with frequent accidents due to brake failure and other incidents related to the antiquated state of signals, tracks, locomotives, and passenger cars. The latest disaster led to the resignation of Egypt's transportation minister, Hisham Arafat. Ashraf al-Ashri, editor of Cairo's Al-Ahram newspaper, told Al Arabiya TV that he believed that both technical and human error were to blame, and that he suspected that the brakes of the train may have failed due to the speed at which the train approached the platform before crashing. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
That report by Uranian from Cairo brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Okokuru by Kebas and Controller.
The pan pan this tip, the CN Records pan this song. Controller Kebas on this song. Cryo, pick up on the owner, bit to bit management, represent to the fullest.
Okokuru, I'm your rhythm. I give you all of my time. Like any Sumaya, the fire Sakaya. You know you mad. She was always beautiful. I thought I could take her home, but now it is the time. Oh, I gotta let you know you're.
We've been listening to Kebas and Controller with the song Okokuru. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Loving ambition. Baby girl, let me sana. Let me sana. I will give you all the time in this world, pana. What you say, what you not pana, baby, call me a fender.
Rule, I'm your rhythm. I'm gonna give you all.
all of my time. Jack and Isumaya, they boy.